Listener discretion advised. Sexually explicit content.
Anyhow, the books. Are you seeing the books? Everything you would want to read is right here. Feel it. Feels good, right? Now smell it. Nothing smells like that.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Did I just see you smell that book?
Dear Reader, a Jane Eyre podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Episode 9, Neck Biters and Bodice Rippers. Greetings and salutations to the 9th episode of Dear Reader, a limited series looking at the classic Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte through the lens of its varied and various interpretations. I'm your guide on this gamble through a gothic romance, Stella. There won't be any continuity for this show, but as always, I do suggest maybe starting with episode 1 if you've never read Jane Eyre, and then of course hop around to what may interest you. Here I'm going to be tackling vampires and erotic romance. And as you heard at the top of the show, the second half is going to be explicit. I'll talk to you a bit more about that and give my warnings after the break so we can just focus on the PG-13 stuff with the vampires. So first I'm going to be looking at Jane Slayer, the literary classic with a blood-sucking twist by Sherry Browning Irwin and Charlotte Bronte. This was first published on March 27th, 2010. It is 391 pages. It has been given a 3.7 out of 5 on Goodreads from 3,875 votes. This author, Sherry Browning Irwin, also wrote The Scoundrel's Vow, Once Wicked, To Hell with Love, Not or Nice, Grave Expectations, which you can imagine is a spin on Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, Thornbrook Park, An Affair Downstairs, and The Great Estate. The back of the cover is as follows. Rita, I buried him. A timeless tale of love, devotion, and the undead. Jane Slayer, our plucky demon-slaying heroine, a courageous orphan who spurns the detestable vampire kin who raised her, sets out on the advice of her ghostly uncle to hone her skills as the fearless slayer she's meant to be. When she takes a job as a governess at a country estate, she falls head over heels for her new master, Mr. Rochester, only to discover he's hiding a violent werewolf in the attic, in the form of his first wife. Can a menagerie of bloodthirsty, flesh-eating, savage creatures of the night keep a swashbuckling 19th-century lady from the gentleman she intends to marry? Vampires, zombies, and werewolves transform Charlotte Bronte's unforgettable masterpiece into an eerie, paranormal adventure that will delight and terrify. And also, right before some reading group questions, there is another synopsis, which I will read to give you a more specific taste of what actually happens in here. And it's called the introduction in this reading group, but we'll say that it's a synopsis. Raised by vampire relatives, young Jane Slayer is forced to adhere to a nocturnal schedule, never enjoying a sunny afternoon or the sight of a singing bird. But things change for Jane when the ghost of her uncle visits her, imparts her parents' vampire slayer history, and charges her with the responsibility of striking out on her own to find others of her kind and learn the slayer ways. She begins at Lowood, a charity school run by a severe, stingy headmaster who Jane quickly discovers is reanimating dying students to be trained for domestic service. With the help of headteacher Miss Temple, Jane frees the souls of her friends and ends their zombified misery. Eventually, she decides to venture out once more, this time as a governess to the ward of wealthy Mr. Rochester, whose dark good looks hide an even darker secret. Deeply in love, she agrees to trust him against her better instincts until a surprise revelation at the altar brings her dreams of marriage to an end. Determined not to become his mistress, for Rochester is already married to a mad werewolf who he keeps locked in his attic, Jane secretly departs. Alone, penniless, and starving, she is rescued from the brink of death by local clergyman St. John, who shelters her with his sisters. Jane recovers and thrills to discover that St. John is a slayer like her. Together, they work to develop new weaponry and train the local children to kill vampires. But when St. John proposes that Jane marry and accompany him on missionary work to hunt vampires in India, she must decide once and for all where her future lies. Now, listeners of this limited series know that I have a nice little rubric that I like to use to guide my thoughts and discussions on the works that I'm looking at, as well as grade some of these interpretations. And it would be superfluous to do this because this is literally an abridged version of Jane Eyre with certain aspects of it slightly changed. So if you can imagine, the author copied and pasted Jane Eyre onto a Word document, removed all the descriptive passages, the ekphrasis and metaphors and things like that, and then changed some of the names and also changed some of the characters and added a couple characters as well. But for the most part, it is very much Jane Eyre. So perhaps for this episode, using the rubric will not be as successful as in previous episodes. But I do want to talk about some of the differences. And then I thought I would use that reader's guide at the end and go through those discussion questions that the author has laid out for reading groups. So, as I said, it's basically the same, but the kisses between Jane and Edward are certainly more intense, whereas they would probably have been closed-mouthed, maybe pecks, I'm sure. Remember, Victorians repressed sexually anyways, and now they're certainly more passionate. Open mouth, she thinks about them, they happen a couple more times, so there's a bit more romance coming through, not as much as in the second half of this episode. Sometimes Jane will kill people, specifically zombies and vampires, without permission, like Rosamund's maid once she is with St. John, and gives the reasoning, of course, that I want to free you, but she doesn't really talk to the people that are also involved in that, and specifically because the zombies are servants, and so you almost wonder what the reaction would be of the person who is employing the servant, but we don't get any resolution to that of, like, where did our maid go? But you just see the end result of the body has hastily been thrown over the balcony, and then Jane has to distract them when a bird carries the maid's head away. She distracts Rosamund. And she especially wants to kill Bertha, which is pretty crazy, just because in the OG Jane, she thinks more about Edward, obviously, but doesn't really have, I think, any negative feelings for Bertha. It's not like she blames her for all of this stuff, but is more in misery over her, of Jane's inability to be with Edward. But here she, like, has daydreams of putting Bertha out of her misery, but then backtracks sometimes and thinks, well, you know, Edward wouldn't like that because he's keeping her there for a reason, and he has compassion and everything like that. So this leads to my next difference, which is that Jane is just bolder in this adaptation. She is bolder in her personality. She's immediately active when a vampire is around her. She has a sense about her, sort of like a spidey sense, and she knows her hackles are up. She knows when something's amiss. And she has a keen engineering intellect, which you see when she helps guide St. John River's designs on a crossbow and a repeat action crossbow. And it's interesting, too, because the author does something smart where she's giving St. John some suggestions and he doesn't readily accept them. So there is definitely that male-female dynamic of why would I listen to what a woman wants? But without her noticing, he changes those designs and then later she sees that. And then later on, he does actually respect her and treat her equally. So there's still that male-female dynamic and social hierarchy. But yeah, it's just pretty crazy how, as a child, obviously, she was pretty bold and she would tell you what she thinks. But then Helen, I think, tempered her a bit and brought her down to a more loving and even-keeled personality. But here she keeps that fire throughout the entire story. I think she's more upfront with Edward and certainly just being as bold as she is to go off and be readily willing to kill some bad guys once they appear is pretty interesting. She considers being Edward's mistress at least three times, which is something that I personally do not care for. But I will say that if I had gone through my rubric, that religion is absent. So that is certainly some of the aspects that is missing from this is the discussion on religion. You obviously have St. John, and that is kept. He is a missionary as well as a vampire slayer, so he's playing that double role. But religion almost has a negative connotation to it or reputation because it's associated with the zombie girls at Lowood, and that reading and memorizing psalms is really, it's what they do day in, day out. And I feel like that might be a commentary of perhaps what, I don't know the author, but perhaps her idea of who Christians are and maybe her idea of them or her experience with them or just people who prattle off Bible verses out of pocket, which as a Christian, I will say that that is actually very annoying if the circumstance demands it, but I really don't like out-of-context Bible verses because that those are the ones that are used and perverted. You need the whole context of the actual passage before you start prattling off something. So to have this group of girls that are just sitting down and memorizing Psalms and to have Brocklehurst rather than Brocklehurst, which I'll talk about, that saying, you know, memorize your Psalms is just like, man, are Christians in the author's mind just like these mindless people who memorize Bible verses and tout them off and condemn people? So there's that. But anyways, to go back to the mistress, I think that that is a big change because if religion isn't guiding Jane, or perhaps she doesn't have as strong a sense of self. And there was an interesting passage which I forgot to highlight and look up to see if it was in the original. But just she says like she has to think of herself first, which I thought was very powerful. And I think that's great. I think that that is true, that oftentimes in Jane Eyre, there is that discussion of religion, and I think that was one of the reasons why it was controversial, is that she does think of herself rather than necessarily like, well, this is wrong in God's eyes, and that's why I won't become a mistress. But I don't like that she has to reconsider that position at least three times, as I said, you know, just her thinking, oh, would it be so bad? I'd be with him, you know, and I could also kill Bertha when I got the chance. Jane would not consider being somebody's mistress, I think, period. I think this just goes against the nature of her character because she's just stronger than that. She's not just a side piece for somebody, and she knows that she respects herself more and she deserves more respect from her male companion. So I didn't like that. She also at one point considers letting a vampire turn her, which I sort of associate those two together. Just a weakness of character that I don't see with Jane. I mean, she does find herself, I think, in these moments of desolation and despair, especially after she is left Thornfield, but that's like the pit of despair. And to be dead set against these vampires, knowing what they are, knowing what her mission is, thinking about her uncle, and then just having the life sucked out of her and thinking, well, you know, maybe it won't be so bad. I mean, I'll have to do something about the blood, but I could hunt them from the inside. And I thought, what's going on? This is not Jane. So moments of a mischaracterization, in my opinion. In this adaptation, St. John says that he, quote-unquote, desires Jane. And I guess he was a bit turned on when he saw her skirt that was ripped and she's in battle-damaged mode after a fight with a vampire. So, very interesting change to have him desire her rather than, you know, see her as an adequate partner and, quote-unquote, enough of love will follow. Here, there's, I guess, the lust factor and enough of love will follow. But, yeah, that's an interesting change. I don't know exactly what I think about that. I guess it makes him seem a bit more human that he does have the desires of a man, whereas in the OG Jane Eyre, he seems like a statue almost, and the only one that can really affect him is Rosamund. So to have Jane also affect him in that way is really interesting. But because of the ripped skirt, it's not like it's her face that drew him in or her abilities, but it was, yeah, he was a bit turned on. So that's also interesting, and I guess is just a very mannish thing to have happened. I feel like she doesn't give herself enough credit, especially at the end. She says that she is, quote, somewhat skilled at slaying vampires, and gives St. John some of that credit, which I feel like it's a strange thing to say. I mean, yes, he had trained her some, but she has an innate ability, as we saw when she was a child, and Miss Temple was instrumental in training her. So all of a sudden, she has to give all this credit to a man and give him some credit. Of course, we see some of these training sequences, and we know that he's been working her hard, and we know that they were working together and creating these weapons. But don't say that you're somewhat skilled, and don't give more credit than is due to St. John. Now, Bertha, who actually became a werewolf when one of her lovers bit her during sex, bites Edward, and then Edward turns into a werewolf. His eyes are, in fact, damaged, but he has no damaged hand. And then when Jane returns, he's not been transformed, but Mary and John, when he's at Ferndean, they strap him up during his transformation times and keep him holed up. If you've ever seen the Vampire Diaries, similar to what they do to some of the werewolves in there. And he doesn't want her to marry him until she sees his transformation in case she has second thoughts. And I thought that this was a big character change or character evolution, because remember that Edward somewhat intends to, I guess I shouldn't say somewhat, I mean, he intends to entrap Jane, because remember, he will not tell her the full story until they have been married 1 year and a day. And knowing full well that this is a big problem, so now he won't marry her until she knows everything. So I feel like that's a great character evolution, and, you know, props to him. And this is where Reader, I Buried Him comes into play, because they go through this whole ceremony where she, well, her uncle had discovered something from Italy of a sort of an antitoxin that helps cure werewolves. And normally it's right after they're bitten, so they have to use a higher concentration and they have to simulate death. So she actually has to bury him, and then he comes out of it and he's okay. So just so you know, but a very powerful phrase to read on the back of the book, like, well, they're not going to get married. He's going to die. What an interesting turn. So he does technically die, but then they are together. And at the very end, Adele has society in Paris, we find out. Jane and Edward have a girl and a boy rather than just the boy. And then St. John doesn't die in India, and they seem to be pen pals. So we see all of that change. Overall, I actually enjoyed this. I was able to speed read it, as I will the second book on this episode, because, like I said, it's an abridged version of Jane Eyre. But when things where when I saw Jane Slayer, when I saw her name or certain aspects, like especially at Lowood, I would say those are that section is the most changed in the book, then I would slow down and see all of the details. And for the most part, names are not changed. Jane Slayer is changed, obviously. That makes sense. And then Brocklehurst rather than Brocklehurst, which seems like an odd change until you find out later from Helen why that name has been changed. She says, "Do you know what a Boker is?" And then Jane says, "As in Brocklehurst?" And she says, "Indeed. In Deepden, we had a maid, a lovely woman with dark skin and fire-bright eyes. We took her in and gave her a home after she'd been thoroughly abandoned by the sea captain who had brought her here from the West Indies. She knew things of a strange religion called voodoo. A Boker is a voodoo priest, a type of sorcerer." And so, basically, once these girls at Lowood die... So he uses it like a farm. These girls at Lowood die, obviously from the deprivation or privation of the situation, and we know what it's like at Lowood. And he raises them up and then trains them. Now they're zombies. Gets them to read their psalms and memorize their psalms. That's all they do every day. They can't taste meat because if they taste meat, there's a frenzy and they go after people, which happens. And then there's a whole slaughter at Lowood in this book. And then he trains them so they basically only listen to him, and later on he sends them off and they are maids and servants for wealthy people, which we actually see Miss Abbott in the Reed's house is a zombie. So Jane had already had an experience of this. But that's why we had the name change, which you don't discover until later, because I thought, why are we, everything's the same except for Brocklehurst. Why is that his name? So, like I said, yeah, I enjoyed it. I think it was an interesting turn. Similar to this, I had read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, so it's not the first time I had read a supernatural bent to a classic. And Jane Eyre, I think, in general, just lends itself well to a supernatural twist. And forgot to talk about the cover, but the one I have is Jane with this almost Mona Lisa-esque smile in her classic garb. And there's blood on her hand as she holds a stake that is sharpened, and there's blood at the tip. There's a cross there halfway up, and then it is wrapped with perhaps hemp or some sort of rope. And at one point, yeah, she gets some Egyptian daggers from Miss Temple before Miss Temple goes away. So it's all very interesting. I was wondering, yeah, what's going to be the change with Bertha? How are you going to switch this up? And to have her be a werewolf, I thought was an interesting change. Werewolves and vampires seem to go very well together. They obviously seem to be enemies. But it is also very interesting that she got her lycanthropy from a lover during sex. And so that, you know, I think speaks to her sexual immorality. Perhaps there's a sense of, well, I'd be shocked, I guess, if we're even looking at that Christian lens from this author. But I mean, that's almost like punishment of, you know, she was sleeping around, she's already a bit mad, so of course she got bit by her lover, and then she contracted this disease, which was, you know, vampirism was a, I don't know, euphemism might not be the best, but a metaphor, I guess, for venereal disease anyways and sleeping around. So it's a similar sort of situation of this is what happened when she was sleeping around with people, which I'm surprised that she, you know, didn't get Edward at all, but he did have some of those vials to help protect him, which is what he did for Mason when he gets bit by his sister as well. So I would recommend this if you like vampires and zombies to a certain extent and werewolves. I've basically spoiled everything now, but if you're interested in Jane Eyre and seeing how that can be turned into a supernatural gothic romance, then I recommend it. It certainly has the spirit of Jane. I wouldn't say the law of Jane because there are some character changes that I don't agree with, but, you know, give it a shot. give it a shot. So, yeah, I thought I would spend the bulk of my time just discussing or, you know, picking perhaps some of these questions, maybe all of them, in this reading group guide and seeing what comes of it. So first, what seems to be more repugnant to the Reeds, that Jane is a dependent of common blood or that she's human? Do you think Mrs. Reed is more irritated that her niece has a continuous flow of warm blood on tap and she doesn't, or that Jane won't share? What finally induces her to beg that Jane help release her soul? So definitely one of the themes that pops through, especially in that section at Gateshead, is this relationship between the haves and the have-nots and social and economic hierarchy. So I would say it's more that she has common blood, and that actually protects her because Mrs. Reed tells her children, do not feast on common blood or you're going to get sick. And it's kind of proven to her with John, because he feasts all, he's all about the common blood to a certain extent, and then he dies. So I would say it's definitely that, and it leans into that difference in welfare. It's an interesting question about if she's irritated that Jane has warm blood on tap or she won't share. I don't think Mrs. Reed regrets at all her decision. I think Mrs. Reed, to turn into a vampire, I think that Mrs. Reed is, she just does not like Jane. I think that's something that transfers over from the OG. And she just, I don't think it's either of those in this particular question, in my opinion. It's just, she does not like Jane. She resents Jane for her husband getting killed because her husband got bit while protecting Jane as a baby. He was vampire slain, and then he turned into a vampire, and then she cajoled him enough to get him to turn into a vampire, and then he basically sacrificed himself or martyred himself because he couldn't do it anymore. He didn't want to be a vampire. So I don't think either of those in that particular question. And then why she wants Jane to finally release her soul, I think a lot of it is because of John. We know how much she loved John, and the fact that he's gone, I mean, that was what broke her in the first place and led her health to deteriorate. So I think she is just ready to be done with everything. And I, maybe in that moment, she, because she seems to authentically be remorseful and repent, I guess, for lack of a better word. And so I think John is the lead up to that, and then she sort of thinks about everything. I don't know that she fully forgives Jane for what she, I think there's still some blame there, but perhaps she in a little way asks for forgiveness from Jane, and then she is just ready to go, and she realizes she doesn't have, I mean, she doesn't have her husband whom she loved very much. Her two daughters are basically out of the door soon, and then her beloved son is dead. So I think it's just, yeah, time to go. Number two, Bessie suggests to Jane that much of the Reed's children's nasty disposition can be attributed to their vampire nature. Do you agree? I think that vampires, well, this is all like as if they're real, but I think vampire dispositions, or becoming a vampire, becoming anything else almost that is not human, I think just heightens who you were initially. So they weren't nice in the first place, and so I think becoming a vampire just heightened that and just let them have all sorts of freedom because they are now pretty high on the power structure. Could there be another explanation? Do you think they would be such immortal brats if they'd been allowed to finish puberty before Mrs. Reed turned them into vampires, and then discuss the effects of being stuck in a child's body forever? So the only other explanation is their upbringing, and that connects to the second part, where if they had been led into, if they completed puberty and were adolescents or adults, then would it have changed? I don't think so, because the upbringing, which is Mrs. Reed, is not the best. I mean, she just really caters to them. She's not the nicest individual, so they're learning from her. I don't really know how we can explain the daughter that, of course, goes to or finds religion, and then in this case, she seeks a nunnery that has a vampiric nunnery who do not prey on people but are pacifists. But I think that's just nature. But I think there's a lot of negative nurture here. So I don't know if there would have been much of a change at all. And the vampirism just heightens their bad traits. And then being trapped in a child's body forever is unfortunate, especially because they were saying that Georgiana had, she was about to be married. That carried over. And then she was about to be married a second time after Mrs. Reed died. But how strange that is to think about that she, I don't know, let's say she was 12. And so these men that are 20s to 30s are like preying upon this 12-year-old girl. So thinking sexually and being trapped in a child's body, that is really unfortunate. And then, just luckily you're at the top of the power chain again. But I think just being preyed upon because you look like a child, not being taken seriously, I think there are all of those negative effects. You really just wouldn't be able to live any semblance of a normal life. But she doesn't. She doesn't choose to. She ends up getting a pack of her own and killing people. Number three, John Reed constantly threatens Jane, who believes his habit of taking small bites of her flesh indicates that he sees her as little more than food. But more astute critics have noted the complexity of John's personality. Left without a male role model, this sad, misunderstood boy in a house full of women may simply be pulling pigtails to get Jane's affection. What effect does his expression of unrequited love have on Jane's adult interactions with men? Okay, well, unfortunately, we're going to see what that quote-unquote pulling pigtails is like in Jane Erotica in part two. This is a good question. I guess the effect that it has is that it trains her for the future. She's kind of used to it from that point on. I think there is, I'm surprised there's not more of a mistrust of men from her because of John. But, you know, she didn't have a male role model either. So her interactions with men have mostly been negative. You've got John, you have Brocklehurst, you have Edward. St. John kind of is decent, but he's so severe that you don't have much either. So the one person, you know, Uncle Reed, who was loving to her, she gets that taste of something resembling love, and it's taken away so quickly. And then her chance at finding her relative leaving to Madeira and being told that Jane's dead, and then he dies, she has no opportunity to have a male role model either. So I think if John is trying to show affection, which I could potentially go for it, if only because we do know that young boys do this sort of stuff to girls they have crushes on. That was something that certainly baffled me in grade school, where this one guy confessed his feelings for me, and I was so baffled. I even said, "What are you talking? Like, you don't talk to me. You're mean to me." And he said basically that that's because I like you, and I don't know, it was hard for me to express things, which is crazy. Like, what's going on there? But anyways, I guess she's just kind of used to this brusque and negative expression from men, that of course she wouldn't think that Edward likes her because, you know, he is sarcastic towards her. He's with Blanche and he's standoffish and all that. So yeah, she wouldn't trust, I think, some of these outward moments of affection that he may have. She would be quite baffled. Yeah, thinking about it now, it is pretty unfortunate that Jane, once she settles down, the positive love that she has with a man is only romantic. And even though they, of course, they call each other their dearest friend, but that she has no male companion that doesn't have a romantic interest in her. And St. John is close, but then of course his ideas got in the way, so she doesn't really have a taste of what it's like to have a male family member that's caring towards her. That's a good question. I've not really thought about John that way. I just think of him very negatively. Number four, the Reeds are famous for hosting extravagant parties featuring buffets of noble-blooded guests. Why do you suppose people keep coming to Gateshead? Is it possible no one cares that so many rich folk have gone missing? How are vampire-related disappearances explained throughout the novel? As for the last question, I don't know that that was dealt with at all, how those disappearances happen. Food poisoning and they all died. I think people keep coming because there's probably a sick fascination if they're hearing rumors, maybe. And then also society, right? If you are invited by people who have social capital, you want to buy into that social capital so that you have some of it. It rubs off on you and you're able to perhaps go up on that ladder as well. So that's probably why. I think... Is it possible no one cares that so many rich folk have gone missing? It's unlikely. We know that poor people going missing, no one's going to care about them. But the rich people, I think that is a bit suspicious. So I am surprised about that. Number five, Jane's charge to kill vampires and release their souls is a godly mission, yet she feels far less angelic than her friend Helen Burns. If Helen is such a paragon of goodness and devotion, why doesn't Jane want to be more like her? Does Helen... What? This is interesting. Does Helen inspire or annoy the crap out of you? Were you surprised that Jane didn't cut off her head sooner? What would you have done? Okay. Who is annoyed by Helen Burns? If that's you, you should be ashamed with yourself. She is a lovely individual, okay? And Jane Eyre would not be Jane Eyre without Helen Burns. So she definitely not annoy the crap out of me. No, I'm not surprised that Jane didn't cut her head off sooner. She didn't want to do that. I mean, what cutting somebody's head off of their dead body is really macabre. And then if that's someone that you love, that, oh, you don't want to do that. You want to have their body and their soul at peace. And she was hoping that it wouldn't happen to her. So I felt so much for Jane that she had to go through that and save her friend's soul and also desecrate her body, which was really sad. I would have done the same thing because you have to, unfortunately, look past what you're doing and what you're seeing and see beyond, like, I'm doing this for your soul. But yeah, that's got to be really hard. And why doesn't Jane want to be more like her? Yeah, in this compared to the OG, there is less of a shift in personality for Jane. I am surprised. I think it's probably her Slayer blood. I think that just makes her bolder. And I think she recognizes the assets in Helen's personality. But in this case, that's just not for Jane. So she's going to go on. Number six, the zombies in this novel appear in two major roles, as poor charity case students and as domestic servants, both groups for whom life is defined by obedience. To kill a zombie, one must take off its head. Do you think the author is making a statement here, or are the zombies just another excuse for the gore so common to 19th century novels? Okay. Are 19th century novels gory? Which have been deemed vulgar... Oh, what? What? Where does this come from? Which have been deemed vulgar by today's more genteel standards. We have genteel standards. I mean, we do have lots of controversial books and banned and challenge books and things. But anyways, if the former, what do you think the author might be saying? I feel like I have maybe discussed this, that I think there might be a statement the author is making about Christianity. And she might be against it. She might be just criticizing Christians and their ability to memorize and repeat Bible verses off the top of their head and I guess act like zombies, and then, you know, the people carrying signs out there condemning everyone to hell if they don't repent. So I guess that would potentially be the statement. I think it adds overall to, I mean, I guess I'm just a bit baffled by the second part of that question. How are these novels gorier, or how are we, number one, how do we have more genteel standards with some of the novels I've read now, especially with what I'm about to read in the second half? But yeah, compared to, I mean, I guess if we think about Frankenstein and Dracula, I don't know. I don't think she's intentionally trying to make this gorier than it's, because she could have done a lot more, I think, with stuff that was happening, especially once there's the feeding frenzy, and she does talk about like the green blood that comes out and everything, but it could have been way worse, believe me. So, and even when the vampires die, they just turn into dust. So I don't think that has anything to do with it. I do think it's a statement. I could be way off with the Christian critique, but I think that might be, that's my thought of what she's doing. So there you go. Number 7, when she leaves Gateshead, where she's been exposed to vampires, zombies, and stories of so much more, Jane develops a tendency to suspect nearly everyone of being unnatural. Is she simply obsessed with killing monsters as Sarah gets for the Reeds, especially John Reed, or does this reflect a more innate narrowness of thought crucial to her slayer destiny? Or perhaps you agree with critics that she's a Victorian feminist expressing her sexual frustrations. Do you think it's a coincidence that she zeroes in most on people who make her uncomfortable, like Grace Poole or Lady Ingram? Is it possible that her instinct is correct? All people are really monsters in disguise. I think the suspicion is because of her traumatic past, that she is just on the lookout, and she knows that she was somewhat protected by Mrs. Reed's stance on common blood and that we're not going to feast on them. But out in the world, she could be set upon by anyone. So you do have to mistrust people until you see whether they can walk in daylight or if they can answer questions or if they have a problem with meat, that sort of thing. So I think having a healthy distrust in people sometimes is safe. Just don't let it be so much that now you're alienating yourself from other people and not letting them into your lives. Sexual frustration. That's interesting. It's just such a reverse, like she's pushing everyone away because of her sexual frustration. You'd think that she'd be trying to draw many people closer or only focusing on the men. So that's a bit quizzical. And I think that in regards to the people that she zeroes in on, it's not only people that make her feel uncomfortable, but also people that are suspicious. I mean, Grace Poole is a suspicious individual and she's haggard looking. She's laughing, or so we think. She's being told, Jane, that she's doing strange things, like trying to set people's beds on fire. So, yes, I would be suspicious. And then with Lady Ingram, I think perhaps that is jealousy there, or rivalry, because if Blanche is a vampire, she can kill her and it'd be a good excuse, and then she can rid herself of a rival for Edward's affection. But also, I think she sees in that party that comes, she sees the Reeds and their extravagance and their social capital again, and thinking, well, it's probably another group that prey on, you know, poor individuals or other people and get away with it. So I think that one's experience, and, you know, Grace is just like, I mean, open your eyes. Grace looks kind of strange and maybe you should be cautious about that. Are all people, gosh, this sounds so cynical. Are all people monsters in disguise? Listen, we are all fallen individuals. We all are wrestling with things inside. We all sin every day. And that doesn't make us a monster. There are monsters out there, and some people are able to mask it, and some people do not mask it. I try to be a good human, and sometimes I fall short of that, but every day I'm trying. So I think that's a really unfortunate way to view the world. And I think that comes from trauma, certainly from trauma, from a history maybe of betrayal, and that you haven't found people to trust. And so that might be people's viewpoint, but I would just say that that person has a story behind that viewpoint. Number 8, at Thornfield, Jane spends a good deal of time ignorant of and then denying her feelings for Mr. Rochester. He seems to drop a lot of hints that she simply doesn't catch. Okay. Do you think her inability to see what's right in front of her, aside from unnatural creatures, is a product of a childhood absent of love? Yep. Or is it a necessary feature for a vampire slayer, as natural to Jane's character as her killing instinct? No, it's definitely being absent of love and needing to realize your self-worth and increase it as well, and mistrusting that if someone is showing you love, is this authentic or is this actually love? Why are you loving someone like me? What's going on? So definitely that. Do you believe she can ever really love anyone? Why or why not? Yeah, I think everyone is capable of love. I think one of our purposes on this earth is to find community and love, whether that is agape love or platonic or erotic love, certainly falls into that. But I think we are all, we seek that out. And sometimes it's harder for some people, I think, given history and trauma and makeup of who they are, they will seek out different love. But yeah, everyone's capable of it. I think Jane just needs to probably, again, work on her self-worth. And also, Edward needs to be reassuring and have conversations. Like, he doesn't help her by doing that whole Blanche switcheroo. Like, I was trying to make you as passionate for me as I was feeling for you. That does not help anything. But hopefully now, once they are actually together, you know, he reassures her and says, I love you. And from that, she's able to really lean into that and be like, wow, you know, this is what love is. I finally found it. Number 9, on page 269, Mr. Rochester exclaims that in revealing the truth about his wife, others may judge, quote, whether or not I had a right to break the compact, end quote. Do you think he's justified, or is he just another Englishman looking to unload his stroppy cow of a wife? Is it significant that Bertha becomes increasingly difficult at the full moon? Do you think Rochester's compassion to care for Bertha, albeit secretly, or is her confinement crueler than simply killing her, as Jane would have done? So let me just say that, yes, I think that Rochester is depicted as being more compassionate in this adaptation than I think even the OG, because of what she goes through, and that, no, he, even through Jane, I think, because Jane is not going to kill Bertha because of Rochester. So he is just not willing to do that to his wife, however much he I guess despises her and has gone through so much because of her, but he protects her and protects other people from her. The confinement is still pretty bad, but also, what else is he going to do with the werewolf? So, I don't know. But yeah, I think he is more compassionate here. I think the full moon is 100% having to do with menstruation and bizarre behavior as far as, you know, what people think of women when they have their periods, when they're on their periods, and that whole thing. So yes, I would say that is probably significant and leaning into some of those stereotypes. And is he justified to break the compact of marriage? This is a hard question, because, you know, the Christian viewpoint, obviously, is that you're going to stick with it and try to work through your issues. And obviously there are, as there, you know, always will be kind of exceptions to that, because you shouldn't be in an abusive relationship, and adultery is an issue as well, should you be with someone. And, you know, there's grace there too, where you could work through with your partner after that adultery has occurred, so long as that trust is rebuilt. But, and I know that's not, honestly, you know, I'm not going to speak for every tale. I'm just giving a couple examples there. He has chosen to stay in that compact, and he, instead of having a divorce or attempting to do something, he just wants an actual healthy marriage. So it's interesting that he doesn't necessarily want to break it. He just wants to add to it. But the mistress is a thing gone too far, but he just wants Jane so much. He's like, any way to have her. He is going to be with Bertha for the rest of his life. I think even with Bertha dead, he is going to carry that weight. So he can't unburden himself. He would not be able to unburden himself no matter what. Number 10. In this novel, killing is a kindness more often than it's a sin. What makes it so in Jane's mind? Do you think she's right in her assessment that she should have killed Bertha Mason and released her from her cursed life? Imagine if Bertha were merely mad and not a werewolf. Would your opinion be different? Of course. Do you think Rochester would really have minded if Jane had killed his wife, or doth he protest too much? Okay, first of all, it's a kindness because, as we're told, it helps release their soul, so they're no longer trapped in this form. Oh, well, it depends on if they repent when they are released from that, but I mean, they're doing terrible things as vampires, and we'll say werewolves, and then as zombies they're basically slaves with no independent thinking or functioning at all. So it is a kindness. You are freeing them and freeing their souls. I think Jane is right. That's hard because I guess this is true really of everyone. The zombies don't have a choice. So I think that very much is she's freeing slaves. The vampires have a choice and Bertha has a choice. The vampires can repent and ask to be killed. So I think there you go, like she's justified in killing. But depending on what Bertha would do in that situation, and also she's not fully aware also because of her madness, so it's hard to do. This is basically like if someone's on trial for doing something and they have a mental illness and they were not, you know, like all their faculties were not there, do they deserve the same punishment or reaction towards their crime as someone who does have all their mental faculties? And then, you know, we've got the reason of insanity sort of plea. So I think we're in that particular situation that Jane really does want to kill Bertha, but I don't think it's 100% altruistic because it's often connected with her thoughts of Edward. You'd have to have a conversation with Bertha. And then, is she of sound mind and body to actually say, yes, I do want to die? And when you connect it to, if you take away the lycanthropy, then that is really bad. Like, no, you're not going to kill a mentally ill person because they're mentally ill and doing things because of that. So, no, that one's a little on the line there. And would he have minded? I think he would have mourned. And also, if Jane had done that, I think that his idea of who Jane is would change, and maybe they would not have gotten together. Number 11, Jane's discovery that St. John, Mary, and Diana are her cousins fills her with joy. But what does it say about the sisters that they choose to distract themselves with such unimportant activities as education when there are monsters to be rid of? Jane often remarks on her desire to be useful. Do you think the other women in this novel, except perhaps Miss Temple, endeavor to be useless? Why or why not? Unimportant activities as education. That's interesting. I think further, some of us have that whole question, all those questions, I think go to the fact that we each, I think, have a particular calling, and we each have talents, and we are edified by certain things and goals and searches. And I think the Rivers sisters are not hunters, and so they are edified by education. They want to further their mind in those pursuits. But Jane's calling is to be a vampire hunter, and so of course she has that. So it's a bit much to say, and that makes her somewhat arrogant and looking down at other people. But it's a bit much to say that those are useless pursuits. There are other people that are going to do that. If we didn't have people interested in education, then there would be no teachers. So everyone has to add to society in some way, and that's what they are doing. And then with the women, I mean, Mrs. Ree's a bit useless, I would have to say. But everyone, you know, Mrs. Fairfax, the servants over there, Rosamond, like they're each doing something in particular to add to society. So, absolutely not. Number 12, ultimately Jane's union with her cousin St. John seems a fulfillment of her uncle's charge to go forth and find other slayers to learn from. St. John's offer to take her to India gives her the opportunity to destroy perhaps hundreds of vampires in a place where they menace unchecked. Why then does she shun her destiny as a slayer in favor of shacking up with Rochester? Who wrote these questions? Do you think she's made the right decision or will come back to haunt her eventually? I think it goes back to that love question. she is able to, that is a great pursuit to go over there and kill vampires in India. Some would be a colonizer, but we'll let that go this time. But she is also asked at another layer to be a wife to someone that she does not love. And so she has found love and she wants to find that again. And she knows, I think in this aspect, love trounces or trumps the vampire slayer part of her. And I think that's fine. I think that goes back to we are in pursuit of love and community. And that's, you know, just in our makeup. And we also know that there are still vampires in England. So it's not like in not going to India, she has just shirked her vampiric duties. She definitely has short-sighted. She's just going to be with Edward. But long-sighted, I mean, she can create a school. She can train other people in England. She can continue her pursuit of killing vampires. It's just not going to be with St. John. And I think it just goes back to that thinking of herself and wondering what she can endure and what she should endure. And in this case, she does not want to pursue a loveless life with St. John while killing vampires. That's just not edifying to her. And finally, number 13, like so many young women dating older men, Jane suffers when her seemingly perfect romance with Rochester is ruined by his beastly ex's refusal to move out, disappear, or just die. And his refusal to simply kill her. Okay, may I just say that that question is, it's a statement, but the beginning of this question is ridiculous. So young women dating older men apparently have issues with their older male lovers having exes that are living with them and refusing to leave? Is that people's experiences? Anyways, do you think she's really horrified to find him blind and infected with his wife's disease when they are reunited? Or is there a bit of her that feels he's gotten his just desserts? What? How difficult do you think it really is for her to bury him 6 feet deep after all he's put her through? Would his ordeal be enough to satisfy you to allow your lover to emerge from the grave with a clean slate? I honestly, I'm not sure who wrote these questions, but there's like a bias dripping all over it. Okay. Jane Eyre is not that type of woman, okay? That just makes her sound super petty and holding a grudge, okay? Now, I can hold a grudge, okay? And I also like to recall people's betrayals from time to time. But that's ridiculous. Jane is not me, and she would not do that. So I don't think she would say you got your just desserts. I think she has compassion for him, and she's also super excited to be reunited with her lover. And I don't think she takes some sort of sick glee at burying him. That's ridiculous. Like, she is super nervous about this whole thing. And she has to be pulled away by John and Mary because she wants to stay with him while this whole thing is going, while that whole ceremony is going on. So absolutely not. And then what is the final part of that question? Yeah, would this ordeal be enough to satisfy you? I don't think she's looking for satisfaction that, okay, you know, this is, you owe me, and so you're going to go through this whole thing and then we can be together. I think that's where grace comes in. So, listen, I've never been cheated on, okay? I don't like the thought of it. I hope it never happens to me. I hope it happens to nobody, but I know that it does. I also honestly don't understand it because just break up with the person instead of cheating on them. But anyways, I don't know in that situation how I would react. If it is someone, you know, that I love and am in love with and that trust is broken, but the person is really remorseful and looking for forgiveness, then I hope that I extend some grace, but it would be hard to come. You have to build that trust back up, right? And I think for me, I think there's only one chance because if it happens again, I would not be able to do it. So I think that there's a lot of grace extended in this section as well because, yeah, he's got this werewolf situation going on. And to give someone a quote-unquote clean slate, I guess after lying and having this wife hidden and all of that, Jane is extending that grace. And again, her compassion, right? Because there's so much more to the story. It's not like he was looking to have multiple wives, just to have multiple wives. There was, he was entrapped in his marriage. There was abuse going on. He went through a whole lot. There's trauma there. And he kept her and did the best he could in that sort of situation. And then found someone that he really loved and wanted to share his life with, and he did this bad thing. So she extends him grace, and he's got to carry that, and she's also going to carry that too. I think as a partnership, that's what's going to happen. You're sharing the load there. But I don't think she's being vindictive about it, like, you do this or else kind of thing. Because he could have died for reals, and then she would have been without. There was a chance that he was not going to make it out, but Edward wanted to take that chance to be rid of this and be with Jane fully. So, yeah, just really interesting questions that lead me to believe that that person does not like Jane Eyre, the character or the original. So, well, from all of those questions, hopefully you got a taste of what this novel is. So I hope you give it a shot and let me know what you think about Jane Eyre being a vampire hunter. Well, it's time for a break. And when I return, you're going to see how erotic Jane Eyre can get. Hold on to your chastity belts.
So which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man.
I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Who's
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Hello. And by hello, I really mean goodbye, because I beg, beseech, and implore you to not listen any further and turn this episode off, for real. And 200% more do I do this if you love Jane Eyre, because you cannot go back. You cannot unsee or unhear what you are about to hear. You've already given me the download, so it's okay. Just turn off the episode. God's nightgown, you're still here. Okay, listen. I can tell you a little bit about this erotica novel, and then there'll be an audio flare, and that really is the last warning you have, that you need to turn back and not listen to the stuff that is going to be exiting my mouth, okay? So I will be, unfortunately, looking at Jane Erotica by Karina Rose and Charlotte Bronte, may she rest in peace and not ever hear this episode, and may she not be rolling in her grave. It was first published on October 4th, 2012. It is 304 pages. It's been given a 2.7 out of 5 stars on Goodreads from 105 votes. And there were a couple others. The other title that was most popular was Jane Eyre Laid Bare, and that had a 2.4 from 692 votes, so more people read it, but it had a lower rating, so I went with Jane Erotica. The author also wrote a book called The Great Gatsby Unbound, and this was the publisher synopsis for that, which I thought you might be interested in. Nick Carraway, a young virgin from Minnesota, moves to New York in the summer of 1922 to find love. He rents a house in the West Egg District of Long Island, a wealthy but unfashionable area populated by the New Rich, a group prone to garish, extravagant parties full of wild, erotic activities. And Nick's next-door neighbor is the worst of them all, a mysterious man named Jay Gatsby, who throws open the doors of his gigantic gothic mansion every Saturday night to house the most opulent, seductive sexual encounters. Mm-hmm. So basically, it sounds like The Great Gatsby meets Eyes Wide Shut. Okay, well, let's talk about Jane Erotica. So this is, and I quote, an erotic retelling of a timeless literary classic. Who gave you the right, Karina Rose? Jane Eyre has lived a sheltered, callous life. Orphaned at a young age and despised by her remaining family, she is shipped off to Lowood School and can only dream of tenderness and affection. Upon accepting a governess position at Thornfield Hall, a world of passion, desire, and sex explodes before her naive eyes. In the form of the brooding, dashing master of the house, Mr. Rochester. After playful attempts to evade Mr. Rochester's advances, playful attempts? Good Lord. Jane finds herself succumbing to his savage, brutal lust and losing herself in the intense heat of her yearning. Jane believes that beneath Mr. Rochester's dark, handsome, and sometimes brutal exterior, there must be a heart, and she is desperate to find love in his hungry caresses. But then she discovers something in the attic, and her world is turned upside down forever. In this cleverly retold classic, says who? Sex collides with corsets. Oh, Lord. Sex collides with corsets in a burst of erotic mashup fiction, bringing the searing heat of 50 Shades of Grey to the dark secrets of one of literature's finest novels, Jane Eyre. Again, who gave you the right, Karina Rose? Okay, let me just say that just like Jane Slayer, the author literally copied and pasted an abridged version of Jane Eyre and then added her own sexy scenes. In this case, it's even more of a literal copy and paste because with Jane Slayer, names had to be changed and some situations had to be changed. But I read this in one day because I could just skim all the Jane Eyre passages and basically it would come to a stop and then there'd be a sex scene and then it would continue on as if it never happened. And this can be a bit jarring because the characters almost after, you know, they've been in flagrante, they almost act as if the past several paragraphs didn't even happen and it's back to usual. And sometimes that works because we know that Rochester is a bit hot and cold, but it's a bit weird. Now, again, I really don't think I need to do my rubric because of what goes on. I mean, if we're talking about religiosity and Jane's character, boy, does that take a hit. Besides, of course, Brocklehurst, I suppose, and all of that, but there's not really much religion to speak of. And Jane, I was thinking from this synopsis that she'd be a virgin upon arriving at Thornfield, and then Edward would take her virginity, and then, you know, we'd go from there. But she is not, so we begin quite soon, and she's already lost her virginity at Gateshead. I really don't recommend this. Now, my friend Donovan, Morgan Grant, whom you may know or have heard me mention because he's a good friend of mine, let me back up and say that as I was reading this, which I, in fact, was reading it at work, even though this would definitely be an NSFW situation, but you know what? It's fine. It would just look like I was reading Jane Eyre. But as I was reading it, I was basically doing a commentary just in a chat with him and my other friend, Harry. And every time, you know, a sexy situation would come up. And then when I finished, I basically said, oh, thank goodness I'm finished with this trash. And he asked, you know, is it trash because it's poorly written and it's not arousing or eliciting any warm feelings or titillating? Or is it trash because, you know, characters are doing what you don't want them to do? And, you know, yes, it is an erotic novel, but I just could not get past the fact that it is my dear and beloved Jane Eyre doing such things. So it's trash in my mind about that, but I suppose it does its purpose. I, again, don't recommend it. I mean, if you're into erotica and you don't know who Jane Eyre is, then go for it. But if you love Jane Eyre, I really don't recommend this because it's really difficult to read. I would say all of these passages, some are more difficult to read than others. And I suppose it has Ooh, I don't even know if it has the spirit of Jane Eyre. I mean, it's literally a copy and paste, but her character has changed so much that I don't think I can say that either. Okay, you heard the final warning. This is, as the Phantom of the Opera says, past the point of no return. Stella goes blue. Okay, so I'm going to be reading all of the sexy passages because out of 15 votes that I got on a Twitter poll, 13 of those 15 said to read all of them. And so you're going to get what you wished for. I will also probably have this unedited. And so if I break into laughter or make some commentary, that's my gift to you to make it more entertaining. But again, I don't know why you're still listening to this. I also suggest maybe having a shot glass nearby and some sort of hard liquor and just taking a shot whenever you hear that there's been a coitus interruptus, because that's gonna happen literally every passage except for one. So get ready. I mean, if you've watched Bridgerton, then season one, then I'm sure you know what you're in for. Okay. So I've got some thoughts, and then I kind of give context of when the sexy situation comes in, and then I read the sexy situation. So at the very beginning, again, like I said, I was under this false presumption that Jane was going to be a virgin. But we are at Gateshead, and right off the bat, I feel like this is Judy Blume on steroids. I mean, Jane is sitting in her window seat, and she's becoming aroused by an image she sees in a book of a dark looking man, or a man with a dark aspect. So of course this sort of foreshadows, I guess that's her type. So it's foreshadowing Edward to a certain extent, and she is caressing herself over the clothing as this is going on. Now, she seems to have some sort of friends with benefits situation going on with John Reed, but only when they are alone, which isn't that the way. He is normally a bully. If they are with his sisters and her cousins, she thinks that it's love. I was freaking out because one of the first scenes, he's kissing Freckles on her chest. And I thought, oh my Lord, she is 10 years old. Okay. So I'm going to save you some intense feelings of discomfiture that I experienced because I'm about to go into a sexy scene as this, and say that the author did age her up to 16, because when I was reading this and that had not been mentioned and I was thinking she was 10 as in the source material, I was not having a good time. Let's just say that. Now, the author does use the phrase lovemaking, but I feel like lovemaking has two different meanings, because you have the act, like sex basically is referred to as lovemaking, but also in an old-fashioned way, lovemaking could also be flirting and making statements of love, or just, you know, compassion and loving feelings towards one another. So I wasn't sure what was being used here, especially since we didn't get any sort of dirty situations. And I thought, well, she's 10, so maybe lovemaking means that. But no, lovemaking does in fact mean the sexy time. Would I call it lovemaking? No, not in this case. But I guess Jane, like I said, she believes that she is in love. So we are coming upon the first sexy passage. And this passage comes after John has hit her with the book, and I believe it's after she's spent time in the Red Room, and so she's back in the quote-unquote nursery, which that is how I figured out she was 16 and not 10, because someone actually, I think the apothecary that comes through, makes a comment that, you're still sleeping in the nursery, you're a little too old for that. I'm 16, sir. Okay, are you ready? Because here we go. Here's passage number one. Jane, I'm so sorry about the book. I did not mean to hurt you. I was only pretending in front of Eliza and Georgiana. You know that. I knew far more than that, so I stayed silent.
But he was not to be so easily put off. John crept across the nursery and right up to my bed. He visited me often in the midnight hours, and we were both lucky that his sisters were such heavy sleepers. Our first meeting had been at night like this some 6 months ago, when John had spent his week home from school pursuing me. I was naive and hungry for affection, and I had fallen right into his arms. "Jane, you know I love you," he said, gently stroking a lock of my hair. I retained the act of sleeping no longer. He did not love me, I knew, but I wanted someone to, and I gently licked my lips as I knew he liked. A glazed look passed across his face, and he bent over me, leaning down on the bed. Gently he pressed himself to me, the sheets between us, and his erection pushed against my stomach. My own groin throbbed with returned yearning. "Oh, Jane," he breathed into my ear, tickling the tiny hairs across my neck. A rush of delight surged through my body, and I tilted my head back, gasping softly and closing my eyes. It was then in my mind that I saw my dark-eyed lover, and it was him that I felt slide under the sheets with me, not John. It was he that moaned my name again, "Oh, Jane." Hot lips found mine and kissed them gently at first, then harder and faster. He thrust his tongue into my mouth, and we tasted... Okay. He thrust his tongue into my mouth, and we tasted the sweetness of each other. Meanwhile, his hands skimmed down my body, cupping my small breasts at first, and then reaching down further between my legs. There he gently rubbed me in tantalizing circles, while ripples of pleasure shocked my body. I bit down firmly on my lip to stop myself from crying out, and my hips jerked with wanting. He stopped rubbing me. He stopped rubbing me and teasingly began running his fingers up and down my stomach, between my navel and my legs, every now and then pinching the delicately soft skin. "I want you," he said, hitching up my nightdress further and hurriedly undoing his own clothing. Again, it was my dark-eyed lover that I felt move on top of me and gently slide between my legs. I caught my breath as he entered me, sending a thrilling twinge bolting up my body. Then slowly he drew himself in and out of me, filling and leaving me. The sensation built a pounding rhythm in the depths of my stomach, but suddenly he stopped. He pulled out of me and came, sighing, "Take a shot." "Good night, Jane," he said, and I was left unsatisfied, as I always was, and now in the full knowledge that I was equally unloved as well.
Ooh, boy. Yeah, so that was the first passage. My only comment really was, again, remember that she is 16, because it's really painful to think of a 10-year-old in that situation. Though a 16-year-old is still problematic, and he's a couple years older than her, so... I know we're at a different time and different cultural standards, but it's still a little... squirmy for sure. And my question would be, John has such self-control to pull out? I don't know. I guess it depends on his level of experience with his body and his level of experience, period. But he doesn't seem like that type of guy. But I suppose he knows that he shouldn't get Jane pregnant because his mother would be upset, and then that's just super awkward. And remember, they're cousins. Okay, so we're moving on. She leaves, obviously, and that's the last time she doesn't see John again. So he took her virginity. You know, what a great guy to do that. At Lowood, she has some encounters with a stable boy. And this is really the only time that the author adds something that is not within, besides the sex scenes, that is not within the source material, that she's adding this new character that Jane bonds with and they have conversations, and then another friends with benefits where they're just kissing, and then it becomes a bit more. Fervent kissing is how it's described. And then we have a sexual encounter inside one of the stalls of the stable.
I usually met Jack on the low stone wall, and together we would walk across Lowood scrubland and eventually tumble under the shelter of an overhanging tree, stripping off our clothes and hungrily grasping for each other. One evening at the beginning of June, however, Jack said, "There's a stable free." I was just turning to take our usual route, and his words took me by surprise. "It'll be warmer than lying out this evening," he added. It was indeed a little chilly. I nodded and followed him along the low stone wall towards the stables. We had never laid together so near the main house before, and the thrill of being discovered sent shivers down my spine. "Jane, you're smiling," he said, tugging on my hand as we entered a dark wooden outbuilding. "I believe that is a first." "There's not much to smile about," I replied, trying to work the corners of my mouth down with the guilty thought that while I lay with a lover, my dear friend lay sick in her bed. "Yeah! What is up with that, Jane?" "Golly, having sex while Helen is dying." "You cannot control everything." And with those words, he shut the stable door and pulled me down onto a stack of fresh, soft hay. We had not met anyone in the yard, nor was there a sound in the stable save the gentle chewing of a pony in the next stall and the distant buzz of a fly. But the thought of being discovered still sent pulses of excitement tingling from my heart to my groin. With trembling fingers, I tore off Jack's loose, dirty shirt. His manual labor had made him thick and defined, and my hands ran up and down his vast, muscled chest, catching the tufts of his fair chest hair in my nails. I bit them into his shoulders gently, and he groaned, pushing his lips to mine. They were rough but tender, and they worked against mine and hunger. Desire sparked inside me, pushing my breasts hard against my stays so that they swelled beneath my dress. Jack stroked them over my uniform, each of his large hands softly caressing and groping them until my breath came out in hurried gasps. Meanwhile, his tongue coaxed mine, touching the inside of my mouth and encouraging my own. Thick, hot desire pooled in my stomach, and the muscles in the deepest part of me clenched in anticipation. He put his great, thick arms around me and hauled me against his body over the hay. One hand remained stroking my breasts, while the other slid upwards to tug at my hair. The rustle of hay as we moved was the only sound that punctuated the stillness of the stable. The light filtering through the rickety wood of the roof spilt dabbled yellow over our bodies, and the air smelt sweetly of summertime. Gripping Jack's large forearm with one hand, I used the other to caress his face and glide it slowly into his hair. Pinning me against the hay, he gently broke free so that he was leaning over me, staring into my eyes. I held his green gaze as he placed both hands on my legs and slowly slid them up underneath my dress. My skin burnt with his touch and my hips ached for him. His fingers an inch from between my legs, he paused and smiled at me, knowing how much I wanted him. I gasped, still holding his gaze, and quickly he dipped one of his fingers inside of me, while pushing his lips against mine and pressing me harder over the hay. I groaned as he moved his finger slowly in and out of me, and I clawed at the hay around me. Suddenly he stopped and began planting kisses across my jaw. I gently bent forward and bit his neck, pinching the skin with my teeth. He responded by pulling my hand over his firm, bulging erection. I tugged his breeches down and took it in my grasp, running my fingers up and down him teasingly. He moaned and hitched my dress up further, maneuvering himself so that he was between my legs, about to enter. I arched my hips, slamming him inside me, and hooked my arms around his neck. He grunted and moved in and out of me exquisitely slowly, sending shoots of pleasure shivering up my body. He sped up and I moaned, meeting his thrusts. He grasped my head between his hands and kissed me hard, pressing his teeth into my lips. He shifted slightly and I could feel something building deep in the knot of desire at the pit of my stomach. My mind drew a blank, all of my wits scattered, and all I could feel was the sensation of him thrusting deeply in and out of me, rocking my body against the hay. Suddenly he pulled out of me and came with a groan. "Take a shot." Abruptly, my desire vanished, and I was left panting and unsatisfied. "Oh, Jane," he breathed, reclining on the hay next to me. I looked down on his stocky, rough body and said nothing. Well, 2 out of 2, Jane does not reach orgasm. So, when's it going to happen? Well, you know when it's going to happen. I also should have said take a shot every time Jane has sex while she's the person on the ground. So, okay, well, of course the first encounter with Rochester would be a bit romantic, and I thought she would immediately admit her attraction, but in no way was I
prepared for this. "Could you hand me my whip?" he said, his deep voice husky. "It is just under that hedge." Obediently, I walked slowly to the hedge and pulled out his riding crop, my eyes never leaving his as I did so. I stopped a few paces from him and extended my arm, offering the tail end. He snatched at it and pulled hard so that I stumbled forward, knocking against his chest. He grabbed me to stop me from falling and held me still, pressed up against him. My breath tore from my throat in hurried gasps and created ragged silver clouds in the cool evening air. I was so close to him that I could smell his faint scent of sweat and leather, and I could see the dampness about his brow. His eyes burnt into mine in a way I had never known. My thoughts scattered. I could no longer contemplate whether this was a true stranger I had encountered on the road or a figment of my imagination, and as a rush of excitement spiked my stomach, I did not care. "You do not need to say anything," he whispered, bringing his face a little closer to mine and throwing the whip aside. "I can read everything I need to know." And he briefly glanced left. and right to check that we were alone, save his great dog, Pilot, and the panting, sweaty stallion. Reminds me of The Crucible. Before I could transpire the meaning of this, he grabbed my hand roughly and pulled me down into the frozen ditch at the side of the causeway. "Really?" There he stood over me, under the shelter of a tall oak tree, hidden by the dusk of the evening. "I'm going to kiss you," he said. He brushed his thumb across my bottom lip, and I began to tremble with anticipation. I'd never laid with a stranger before, but this man did not seem unknown to me. He was my young desire come alive. His dark eyes gleaming with excitement, he brought his soft, full lips firmly down onto mine, forcing my teeth apart with his tongue and tasting the sweetness of my mouth. I was breathless and my chest heaved in the confines of my stays, my breasts almost bursting over my corset. With one hand he cupped my chin, whilst the other tore off my bonnet and began to rake through my hair. I whimpered and moaned into his mouth, feeling his grip on my chin tighten. He abruptly pulled back from me and his eyes bore into mine, their intensity thrilling. Slowly and gently he pushed me down so that I was lying against the cold, hard ground. "Okay!" And he moved over me. Silently, he tilted my head back to gain access to my throat and let his lips glide down to my chest, kissing and nipping my tender skin. A hotness gathered in my groin and filled me with hungry desire. As his lips moved across my chest and back to my neck, to the soft, small dip at the base of my throat, I closed my eyes. He was nothing like the inexperienced clutching of John Reed or the clumsy, coarse touching of Jack. His lips and hands moved expertly over me, feather light, yet firm at the same time, teasing my senses. He paused and I opened my eyes, losing myself in the mysterious depths of his. Emboldened, I reached up a hand and knotted it in his hair, bringing his lips firmly back to mine. I thrust my hips against his, feeling the hardness of his erection through my dress and petticoat, which sent shivers up my body. My hips began writhing and swaying of their own accord in the same rhythm of his mouth against mine. "Keep still," he growled. I obediently stopped, my nerve endings tingling. Slowly he pulled my legs apart and slid hands underneath my dress. He gently rolled my stockings down and I winced at the coolness of the evening air on my bare skin. Above me, all I could see was the duskiness of the sky and a scattering of stars. He reached between my legs and rubbed his thumb up and down me, watching my reaction. I fidgeted uncontrollably, a tight feeling of wanting coiling inside. He bent over me, hitching my dress up further so that from my navel down I was completely bare, and ran his tongue across the tops of my thighs. Suddenly he dipped between my legs, and I could not help but cry out in surprise and pleasure as he moved his tongue in slow, tantalizing circles, teasing me until I thought I might explode. My hands clenched into fists and I panted. When I thought that I could not go on any further, he stopped and unhid his breeches. I let out an involuntary gasp of shh. I let out an involuntary... Okay.
I let out an involuntary gasp of shock at the size of his erection, and he grinned. I ran my hands up and down it gently at first, and then harder, angling it towards me. Suddenly, he grasped both of my legs and pulled them onto his shoulders, lifting my hips off the ground. I glanced at him in confusion, but before I could speak, he thrust himself inside of me, and I could but moan with rapture. I convulsed as he pulled out of me and then sunk slowly in again, pushing deeper than anything I had experienced before. It was too much, and I began losing myself in my senses, only conscious of the delicious thrusting between my legs. I felt heat and desire building in my stomach and flooding my groin, pulling me into a hazy, fractured place where I had no control. I was clutching his cloak desperately, wishing that I could run my hands over his body and feel his broad chest. He started to move hard and fast. My insides felt like they were being wrung raw, and I squirmed with built-up pleasure, waiting to burst as he pounded into me deeper and harder. He leant forward and kissed me so softly, his mouth caressing mine, before taking my bottom lip into his teeth and biting down. Suddenly I exploded into tiny pieces as he heaved into me once more and collapsed back onto the cold ground, barely knowing who or what I was. It was an ecstasy of pleasure I had never felt before, and I whimpered and sighed as I slowly recovered. He pulled out of me and grunted, "Coming. Take a shot." We were both still for a moment as he lay over me. Finally, he lifted his eyes to mine, those deep, dark eyes, and I asked, "Is your ankle better, sir?" He let out a bark of laughter and pulled down my dress. "I'll live," he said. I frowned as he hurriedly stood up and pulled his breeches back on. I did not want him to leave. I could not bear to return to the silent nunnery that was Thornfield Hall.
Okay, so this encounter really throws everything off for me, even if we just look at Rochester, because he obviously, right, he wanted someone different than the other women he had as he was globe-trotting or sex-trotting through Europe, and doesn't this bring Jane closer to being those other women? And, of course, when he asks her to be his mistress, she technically already was, and so really what's stopping her? She also loses something of her independence by being so sexually free with Rochester and later on so desirous of him that she can't leave him, whereas she knows that she doesn't want to, but she knows that she needs to leave him, will leave him, and does leave him, and that's, you see that independence the entire way through, but here I feel like there's just too much of an attachment because we had sex right on the go-round. Also, I mean, that's great for you, Rochester, that you're on top of someone, but Jane is basically naked in a frozen ditch, and you didn't even put your cloak down? I mean, come on. Okay, the next sexy scene comes after Bertha's attempt to burn his bedroom.
"Good night then, sir," said I, quietly making to go. He seemed surprised. "What?" he exclaimed. "Are you quitting me already, and in that way? You said I might go, sir. You have saved my life, Jane. I have a pleasure in owing you so immense a debt. I cannot say more." My heart quickened in my chest, and my breath fluttered from my mouth in gasps. Fixing his dark eyes upon me, he took a step closer, and the hairs on the back of my neck tingled. "Sir," I whispered, but found that I could not go on. He reached out a hand gently, taking hold of my waist and never breaking his gaze. He pulled me into him so that I was crushed deliciously against his damp chest. The wet material soaked through my nightgown and felt cold against my bare breasts. My nipples hardened, and I pressed myself against him, feeling his heart beat and the warmth of his body against mine. I deliberately skimmed my tongue across my bottom lip, wishing he would kiss it, and I was rewarded when his eyes widened and glinted wickedly. Suddenly his grip tightened on my waist, and he wrenched me towards him, clamping his lips to mine. Then delicately he pushed his tongue into my mouth and moved it in soft circles, leaving a scalding heat of desire wherever he touched. I sucked hard on his tongue and heard him groan in a pleasurable laugh. He returned the gesture by pinning me firmly against his hip so that I could feel his long, hard erection across my belly. I ran my hands down his nightshirt, noticing the enticing undulations of muscles across his stomach, and crept my fingers further, past the soft humps of his hip bones to his bulging erection. His eyes closed briefly, and I felt his whole body stiffen with anticipation. Gently, I ran my fingers up and down it, feeling its smooth, hard texture. Abruptly, he took his hands away from my waist and closed them over mine. "Like this," he whispered huskily, closing my hands into a firm grip and moving them up and down. He moaned quietly as I carried on and moved his hands back to my waist, then up into my hair. I had never done anything like this before, and the thought that I was giving him such pleasure sent scorching waves of desire rippling through my body. He began kissing me in rhythm to my hands, tugging him and pulling gently on my hair. This was unlike anything I had ever done with John Reed or Jack, and I felt completely in control. I suddenly pulled back from his kisses, and he glanced at me in shock. Tilting my head slightly, I kissed his neck passionately and began working my way down his body. I left a hot trail of kisses across his torso and down between his legs, where I paused and slowly knelt on the wooden floor of his room at his feet. He looked down at me, breathing heavily, his great chest heaving and his dark eyes full of yearning. With slow deliberation, I leant forward and placed my lips around him tentatively, running my tongue over the tip of him. His mouth dropped open slightly and his breathing increased. Gently I sucked, and he was soft and hard all at once. His hips flexed into my mouth, and I pulled him in deeper. He let out a low groan as I pulled out, twirled my tongue around. He let out a low groan as I pulled out, twirled my tongue against the tip, and then sucked him quickly back into my mouth. My hands grasped his thighs as I pulled him into me deeper and deeper, loving the sensation of his fingers grasping my hair in ecstasy. I sucked harder and harder, feeling him writhing, and glanced up at him. His eyes were blisteringly hot into mine, filled with hungry need. I pulled the tip of his erection to the back of my throat. That's Jane choking, and felt him convulse with pleasure. He grunted and slammed his hips against my mouth as warm, salty liquid oozed down my throat. Good Lord. After a second, I swallowed and he sighed. I moved away from him and stood up, pleased that his brow was damp with sweat and his eyes were glazed with pleasure. "Jane," he whispered, "lie down on the bed." I shook my head. "Another time," I heard myself say, and I felt myself grin. "Soon," I added, before bobbing him a curtsy and leaving the room.
Okay. That's all I can say. This scene that just happens makes me question why he would bring Blanche to make Jane jealous. Clearly, you don't need to do that, nor question her feelings for you with what just happened. But he does say, of course, you know, "I wanted to make you as mad for me as I was for you," that kind of thing. So I guess if this is teasing him, then maybe it makes sense. But anyways, okay, the next sexy scene comes, I suppose we could say, during the Romani scene or after he is revealed anyways.
"I did not come to hear Mr. Rochester's fortune. I came to hear my own, and you have told me nothing of it."
"Your fortune is yet doubtful. Chance has meted you a measure of happiness, but it depends on yourself to stretch out your hand and take it up. Whether you will do so is the problem I study. Kneel on the rug."
I knelt, and she did not stoop towards me, but only gazed. Leaning back in her chair, I looked into her eyes, and they were dark, mysterious, and familiar.
"Rise, Miss Eyre, and leave me. The play is played out."
Where was I? Had I been dreaming? Did I dream still? The old woman's voice had changed, and her accent and her gesture were all familiar to me. I got up, but did not go.
"Well, Jane, do you know me?" asked a gruff voice.
"Only take off the red cloak, sir." Mr. Rochester stepped out of his disguise, and I gasped.
"Now, sir, what a strange idea," I said, flushing and wondering if I had revealed too much in our conversation. "It was mere folly. Do you forgive me for it, Jane? I cannot tell till I have thought it all over. He stood and abruptly moved closer to me, his eyes boring into mine. I will make it up to you, he breathed. I believe I owe you a favor. My blood rushed to my head and my abdominal muscles clenched with excitement. My head told me not to adhere to the wishes of this man that treated me so inconsistently and was practically the bridegroom of Miss Ingram. But I could not help it. I wanted every last moment I could snatch with my master before he was completely lost to me. And what favor would that be? I asked, my voice trembling slightly. His eyes blackened with desire and burnt into mine with such blistering heat that I had never before known. I was gasping, although he was not touching me, and yearning pumped through my whole body, filling me with desperate need. "Come to me, Jane," he whispered, holding out his hand. I shook my head. "No, you come to me," I said. He raised his eyebrows in surprise, but the corners of his mouth tugged up in a devilish smile, and he obediently crossed the distance between us, wrapping his great arms around me swiftly and slamming his lips against mine. My breath hitched in my throat. I surrendered myself to his violent passion and let his hands run the length of my body, caressing my breasts through my dress and tearing at my hair. I let out a yelp of pleasure as he bit down hard on my lip and sucked and smoothed it better with his tongue. Then suddenly he bent down and scooped me into his arms, his lips still fiercely pressing against mine, his tongue darting in and out of my mouth. He carried me over to the table and laid me down upon it. "Stay still," he instructed, leaning over me and delicately brushing my hair back from my face. Then slowly he peeled back my dress and petticoat. I lay against the cold, hard table, again, wishing that I were completely bare, and he too, so I could finally run my hands across the skin and dark hair on his broad chest. We had never been completely bare with each other before, and I suddenly wanted it like nothing else. I tried to move my hands back to unlace my dress, but he stopped me. "Not now, Jane," he said with a wicked grin. "Later. Right now, this is you only." I gently sank back against the table in sweet rapture as he trailed kisses across my neck and chest, tenderly kissing, sucking, and nipping the skin so that my senses quaked and shivered with longing. He ran his hands down the length of my body and slid them beneath my skirts. Then he pulled down my stockings ever so slowly, kissing each bare piece of skin as it exposed itself and licking the length of my thighs. I moaned softly and convulsed, quivering. He began kissing my ankle and then gliding his lips up my calf before pausing and doing the same on the other foot, teasing me. "Please," I begged. Without responding, he kissed up my calf again and then carried on across my inner thigh, pushing my legs apart. I gasped, desire strong in me and my whole body tingling with coiled anticipation. He took each of my legs and hooked them over his shoulders, pushing them even farther apart, and I writhed. Softly, he pressed his lips between them, and then very gently he ran them up and down as I shuddered and groped with delight. He waited calmly for me to pause, and then, locking his eyes with mine, he plunged his tongue inside me. My body sung from the deep touch and bowed uncontrollably with pleasure. He circled his tongue, grating against me and building up a steady, torturous rhythm. I found that I could no longer regulate myself. I gave myself up to him completely. Every part of me was solely concentrated on the scorching heat between my legs, and my body was ridged with ecstasy. He dipped his tongue back inside me, and I panted and whimpered. His tongue flicked in... Oh, good Lord. His tongue flexed in wide circles, pulling me luxuriously apart and sending ripples of heat shooting through me. It was too much, and my body begged for relief. Letting go, everything slipped away, and I was lost in lust and the strength of an intense euphoria. My insides clenched to a climax, and I cried out before they released blissfully. Mr. Rochester stepped away from me and grinned. I could barely respond except to sigh a satisfied sigh. "This will do for now," he said. I gingerly sat up and began rolling my stockings on. Mr. Rochester watched me, deep in thought. "Tell me," he said suddenly, "what do you believe the people in the drawing room yonder are doing?"
Okay, yeah. So it
just an example like that. It's so weird that after all these sexual encounters, it immediately is back to business as usual. And by business, I mean, you know, the source material. As if nothing strange has happened. In that case, I guess we should all applaud Mr. Rochester for giving back, paying back, equating. Paying it back, I think, works. What Jane had done, so thank you very much, because sometimes it just seems like the guys take, 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 and never give, 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 so there you go. And she has another orgasm, so I guess that's good for her. Okay, the next sexy scene comes when Mason gets attacked and is led to the carriage by the doctor. So think about where we are as this is happening.
You have passed a strange night, Jane.
Yes, sir. In some inexplicable way, when he looked at me, I did not feel so afraid.
You look pale. Were you afraid when I left you alone with Mason?
I was afraid of someone coming out of the inner room.
But I had fastened the door, and I had the key in my pocket.
You were safe. I did not reply. Instead, I was caught by the change in his dark eyes, the way they seemed to pull me towards them and glitter in the low candlelight. Leisurely, he took a key from his pocket and walked over to the door. He slotted it in the lock and turned it with a flick of his wrist.
"We need not be disturbed," he said.
It was remarkable how quickly all the horrors of the night slid from my mind, and I became aware that I was standing before him in just my nightdress and shawl. My breath became shallow, and I found I could not move. He, too, was wearing his white nightshirt and breeches, and I longed to finally pull them off and see him completely unclothed, our bare skin pressing hot and warm against each other. Before that commotion set about, I am aware that I promised we would resume our meeting later, he said, walking steadily towards me. I clenched my fingers in rich anticipation and felt my heart beat rapidly in my chest. For once, I was not burdened by my corset, and my breasts heaved with excited, hurried breaths. Still, he moved closer to me, taking his time and enjoying my obvious violent lust. I wanted to step forward and quickly remove the distance between us, but I found I could not. His dark eyes hypnotized me to the spot. Instead, I felt my nerve endings quiver and a throb tore through my groin, tingling and deep.
"You look different without your stiff dresses, Jane," he said huskily, reaching out a hand with his last step and tracing the curve of my cheek.
I started with pleasure at his warm touch, and a wave of desire burst through me. Gently he undid my plait and worked my hair out with his fingers, locking his eyes on mine as he did so, until it was completely free and I was gasping quietly. He brushed it over my shoulder and let it hang down my back.
"I think it would look better against your bare skin," he said darkly.
In quick, fervent movements, he tore off my nightdress and undergarments and threw them on the floor. Then he stood back, and his inky black eyes darted to every part of my naked body, drinking me in. Lust flamed in the redness of his cheeks, and he slid his hand around the arch of my hip to the warm dip in my lower back. I took his hand away, and he frowned in confusion, but then I tugged on his nightshirt.
"It's your turn, sir," I whispered quietly and seductively in his ear. He shivered slightly and grinned. "As you wish, Jane," he said.
He undid his breeches and let them fall to the floor, unleashing his large erection, and then he whipped his shirt over his head, revealing his great broad chest. I sucked my breath in upon seeing his curved, firm pack of muscles, and could not help but reach out and run my fingers through the tufts of dark hair, down the humped skin of his stomach to the flat smoothness of his hips.
"Lower, Jane," he breathed.
Obediently, I let my fingers glide lower, and taking him in both hands, I slowly tugged. He groaned and convulsed, running his hands up and down my spine in tickling, sweeping motions in return, and wrapping my locks of hair around his wrists. I let my hands move faster, feeling him harden and pulse between my fingers, and feeling his breathing get heavier against my neck. Abruptly, I stopped, and my hands were back to caressing his toned chest. I giggled softly at his disgruntled expression. Suddenly, he pulled my hair sharply, throwing my head back, and then pressed his mouth to mine. His tongue gently prized my teeth apart and tasted the walls of my mouth, teasing my wanting from me. As he did so, I felt his hands drift down my sides, leaving a trail of scorching heat to my hips where he reached around and clasped my buttocks, cupping the soft cheeks and fingering the crease between my thighs. Putting each of his hands on the backs of my legs, he pulled me up against him with a grunt, thrusting his tongue further down my throat and pressing his throbbing erection to me. I returned his kisses eagerly, taking his bottom lip between my teeth and biting down gently. This produced another groan, and his fingers clenched my bare skin. He hoisted me up further, and I wrapped my legs around his torso, returning his kisses with an even greater fever. He carried me over to the bed and threw me down, standing over me. I looked up at him, gasping against the soft, clean sheets. Holding my gaze, he removed a curtain tie from one of the bedspreads. I was confused when he uttered huskily, "Put your hands out in front of you." I obeyed. Quickly, he wrapped the golden curtain tie around my wrists and pulled the knot tight. Then he pushed my hands up over my head, pinning me in place. He took my nightgown from the floor and folded it into a long strip. Then, bending over me, he placed it over my eyes and secured it at the back of my head so that I was unable to see anything. "Relax and enjoy this dream," he whispered in my ear as arousal coursed through me. Beginning at my hips, he ran his hands up my body and paused at my breasts. He fingered the smooth skin of my nipples, letting them harden under his touch, and ran his thumb down the deep well between my breasts. I could not see any of this, and each caress was unexpected and erotically heightened. Suddenly, I felt him lick my right nipple while his free hand pinched and flicked the other. I gasped as he let his tongue circle my breast and then blew gently on it, making me shudder with delight. Then I felt him sucking hard and flicking his tongue backwards and forwards, and it was all that I could do to stop myself from crying out. He gently and carefully took my nipple between his teeth and bit it. He paused and allowed me to recover a little before shifting slightly and suddenly. I felt him doing the same to my left breast, licking, sucking, and nipping it until I was in a frenzy of passion. I clawed at the bedsheets above my head and tried to bring my hands in front of me so that I could touch and clutch him back, but I could not. As my lust began building, I flexed my hips against him, aching for him to be inside me. "Please," I heard myself beg. I could not see, but I felt that he grinned back at me wickedly. He left my breasts, and his fingers traced languidly across my belly and lower abdominal instead. I began to pant as slowly he let them creep over my hips and between my legs. I could not see, and so each touch was magnified, didn't you say that before, and a deep, extreme pleasure raged through my body. He gently ran his finger up and down before suddenly dipping two fingers inside me. I convulsed, and my body bowed with pleasure, my wrists straining against the curtain tie. As he moved his fingers in and out of me, I pushed against him, lifting my hips up, begging. His fingers moved faster before stopping completely and leaving me in a hazy, hungry state, gasping and wriggling with desire. "All right, Jane," I heard him say softly. "So he's edging her." I felt him shifting, and suddenly he plunged himself inside me. I cried out from the suddenness of it and came instantly, and then again and again, as he pounded deliciously into me, hooking my legs over his back and pulling him deeper. I could barely believe it as I felt something new building with each thrust. A hot spasm pooled in my groin, and I clenched my teeth as it coiled into more. It tightened and tightened before it climaxed luxuriously and shattered into tiny fragments, collapsing back onto the sheets, exhausted. My senses were wrung raw, and my body tingled with the aftermath of pleasure, my head light and dizzy. I felt him pull out of me, and I heard him grunt as he came, "Take a shot." After a moment, my vision was restored and my wrists freed. I glanced around the room with weak, delirious eyes and felt my chafed wrists, which were imprinted with the pattern of the curtain tie. "Thank you, Jane," said Mr. Rochester, lying beside me. "Thank you, sir," I replied, and we were quiet for a few minutes. "Little friend," said he in quite a changed tone. His face changed too, losing all its softness and gravity and becoming, who knows what it's becoming. Okay, what? This was right outside of Bertha and Grace Poole's room. Why would you do that? Author, why would you write that? And what? Yeah, absolutely, 100%. No! Man, and then, yeah, later on, he actually talks about Blanche,
which just WTF. Why would you do that after you had sex with somebody? This is as bad as something else, which is a comic reference. But basically, Dick Grayson having sex with Barbara Gordon, and then once he leaves, leaving his wedding invitation to Starfire on the bedside table. That's messed up, and so is this. Okay, hey, the next scene is outside again, and this happens after the proposal. And I will say that I think this adaptation, as well as the other one, the author really cut up the proposal, which is a bummer just because of how beautiful it is. But he all of a sudden says, like, poor and obscure as you are, I'm like, where did you get that? She has to say that first. Otherwise, you're just being offensive. So, yeah, they really kind of cut it up. And it's not as romantic and well-written as the source material.
You are a married man, or as good as a married man. Let me go, I said, pulling away. Jane, I ask you to pass through life at my side, to be my second self and best earthly companion. You mock me. I do not. I summon you as my wife, and it is you only I intend to marry. Come hither. Your bride stands between us. My bride is here, he said again, drawing me to him, because my equal is here, and my likeness. Jane, will you marry me? Still I did not answer, and still I writhed myself from his grasp, for I was incredulous. Do you doubt me, Jane? Entirely. I would not, I could not marry Miss Ingram. You poor and obscure, small and plain as you are, I entreat you to accept me as a husband. I must have you for my own, entirely my own. Will you be mine? Say yes, quickly.
See? Loss of independence.
I stared at him uncertainly. Oh, Jane, you torture me, he exclaimed, with that searching and yet faithful and generous look. You torture me. Do you truly love me? Do you sincerely wish me to be your wife? I do, and if an oath is necessary to satisfy you, I swear it. Then, sir, I will marry you. Come to me entirely now, said he. With some trepidation, I closed the distance between us, stepping into his arms. He enclosed them around me and held me tightly to his chest. Oh, Jane, I love you, he whispered. I tilted my head and looked up into his sincere dark eyes. In turn, they scrutinized mine and then began to spark with the heat of desire. I felt it too, a rippling sensation beneath my petticoat that was delicious and warm. My blood boiled with it, and a torrent of passion swept through me. He gently cupped my chin with his hands and slowly brought his lips to mine. Overhead, I heard a slight breeze ruffle the branches of the chestnut tree in the duskiness of the evening, and the nightingale began its song once more. His lips against mine burnt like fire, and my own body answered by pressing his with a desperate, hungry fever. At first we were delicate, but all at once craving overtook us, and we grasped for each other with trembling fingers and heaving chests. As he pulled away from me, my breath hitched in my throat, and I slid my hands beneath his jacket, letting them roam eagerly across his broad chest. His dark eyes were soft and loving, whilst being fierce and commanding at the same time, and all at once I realized that he did love me, for I had never seen that look on his face before, or rather, it had always been hidden. I began sinking to my knees and pulling him down also, my hands clasped round his neck, my fingers knotting themselves in his hair. I want to lay with you here, right now, I whispered, a smile spreading across my face. He gave me a devilish grin in return and took me by the waist, pushing me to the ground. The earth was cool and moist, but I did not pay it much heed as he pinned me against it. I will take you here, Jane, but I want you to be bare, he said. We were alone in the grounds of Thornfield, and on an evening like this, it was unlikely that we would be disturbed.
Unlikely, but not impossible, Jane.
I've wanted to do this since I met you on the causeway and you bewitched my heart, he added. I thought you had forgotten that time, sir. Oh, Jane, I never forgot. With that, he roughly turned me over and began began expertly unlacing my dress. He had it undone in seconds, and my undergarments were soon off and pooled beside me. The cool breeze against my bare skin made me shiver, as did my intense anticipation. I made to turn around, but he stopped me. Stay where you are, he said huskily. My heart thumped in my chest and waves of yearning coursed through my body. He lightly touched his forefinger to the nape of my neck, and then, achingly slowly, he ran it down my spine, grazing my back with his rough nail. I shivered. Next, he placed his tongue at the base of my spine and licked up between my shoulder blades into my neck. I gasped in surprised delight. He paused for a moment, and I heard a soft scuffling sound as he removed his clothes. I tried to turn to look, but he said, "Ugh, no, Jane." Suddenly, I could feel his warm, bare skin against mine as he pressed his chest to my back. I shuddered with pleasure as he pulled my buttocks into his lap, and I felt his long, hard erection between my legs. "Oh, Jane," he grunted. He grunted as he leant down and smelt my hair. My breathing became shallow as he nuzzled his nose against my ear, gently bit the lobe, and then trailed kisses across my neck. Meanwhile, his hands stroked my stomach, skimmed my ribs, and took each of my breasts firmly in his palms. His lips began to lick, kiss, and nip my shoulders as his hands massaged my breasts, and his fingers tugged and flicked my nipples. I leant into him, pressing myself as hard against him as I could and throwing my head over his shoulder in pleasure. "Is this physically possible?" He responded by gently biting my chin. "Okay." My hands caressed his thick, muscled thighs, and my nails dug into his skin as hot yearning raced through me. Suddenly, he pushed me forward so that I was on my hands and knees. Hands and knees, and I gasped at the shock of it. I made to turn around, but again he stopped me. He placed each of his hands firmly on my waist and leaned into me, brushing his erection against my thighs. I sighed with wanting and sank down onto my elbows, pressing my cheek to the earth. Come on. Without warning, I heard a sharp slap and felt a sting of pain as he smacked my behind, and before I could react, he slammed into me, forcing me to cry out. The feeling was deeper than anything I had experienced before. You know, if he goes any deeper, pretty sure that something's going to be punctured. He pounded into me again and again, faster and faster. I groaned as an intense thrill coiled in my stomach and threatened to overflow. His hips thudded against my buttocks, and I clenched my teeth in unbelievable pleasure. My whole body convulsed and bowed as I climaxed. I cried aloud, collapsing against the hard, wet ground. Waves of ecstasy rocked my body, and my limbs tingled with release. A second later, Mr. Rochester pulled out of me and came. "Take a shot." He lay down beside me as we both panted, our brows sweaty and our bodies trembling. We stayed in companionable, blissful silence for a while, staring at the sky as stars began to appear. However, it was clear that the wind had picked up, and we noticed a cluster of dark clouds moving in the way. "We must go in," said Mr. Rochester. "The weather changes. I could have lay with thee till morning, Jane." "And so I whispered. The rain began rushing down, and we hurried back into our clothes. He helped me with my dress. Did you help wipe the dirt off of her? Then hurried me up the walk to the house. He was taking off my shawl in the hall and shaking the water out of my loosened hair when Mrs. Fairfax emerged from her room. I did not observe her at first, and nor did Mr. Rochester. "Good night, my darling," he said, kissing me repeatedly. When I looked up, on leaving his arms, there stood the widow, pale, grave, and amazed. I only smiled at her and ran upstairs. Explanations will do for another time, thought I. Still, when I reached my chamber, I felt a pang at the idea that she should even temporarily misconstrue what she had seen. How can you misconstrue? Who knows if she had seen you out the window? But joy soon effaced every other feeling, and loud as the wind blew, near and deep as the thunder crashed, fierce and frequent as the lightning gleamed, I experienced no fear and little awe. Before I left my bed in the morning, little Adele came running in to tell me that the great horse chestnut at the bottom half of the orchard had been struck by lightning in the night, and half of it split away. Well, it probably did that out of shame, since Jane and Edward did it doggy style. And Jane's too good for that, is all I have to say. And yeah, you are absolutely lucky that that is all Mrs. Fairfax witnessed, just that kiss and not anything more. The next sexy scene takes place after going to Millcote for shopping in preparation for the wedding. That evening, Mr. Rochester called me to his presence, and I readily fulfilled his wishes, meeting him in the drawing room where he was sitting in an armchair. "Come here, my love," he said as I entered, and I saw a warm smile stretch across his handsome, dark face that reassured me. "It was torture to be with you all day and not be able to touch you," he said as I approached. I perched on the arm of the chair, but he pulled me into his lap, running his hands over my waist, and I giggled. "You did touch me, sir," I said, thinking of our stolen caresses that were carried out whenever we thought and hoped no one was observing us. He grinned. "Oh, yes, but I should like to touch you some more." He smelt deliciously of leather and sweat, and I told him so. "I have just been riding," he said with a laugh, indicating his muddy boots, and then he paused. "What is it, sir?" I asked. He reached down beside his chair and grasped a riding crop. He held it in both hands in front of him, his eyes glittering deviously. I did not follow what he meant, and I looked confused. "Dear Jane," he purred, "how should you like pleasure and pain?" I still could not fathom what he meant. "Sir, I only want you," I said truthfully. "Yes, and I only want to please you in any way that I can." He ran the whip through his fingers and caressed the warm leather. "I was thinking of you as I rode," he said, "and I should like to ride you now." "Who says this?" I swallowed, and a thrill shot through my body, making the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end. I desired that too, and I felt a deep blush rise to my cheeks. "Stand, Jane," he added. "I will undress you." I obeyed, and he gently began unlacing my dress. His movements were feather-light, and I could barely feel it as he dropped my bodice to the floor and began on my corset. With deliberate tenderness and the softest of touches, he removed all of my garments until I was bare. I stood naked in the drawing room, feeling bashful and wanting to cover myself. "Jane, you look beautiful," he whispered. I turned to him. The whip was in his hand. "It is your turn," I said softly, stepping towards him. With our eyes locked, I slowly removed his clothing too, his jacket, shirt, and breeches, until he was bare. He stood before me with his strong, muscled torso, chest of short black hair, and sculpted thick legs. Then I reached out and gently ran my hands up and down his smooth... firm erection. He closed his eyes and groaned under his breath. I went to kiss him, but he moved away. "Hold out your hand, Jane," he said. I did as he asked, confused. He turned it so that my palm faced upwards, and then suddenly he swiped it with the riding crop that whistled through the air. I yelped with shock, but it happened so quickly that I barely registered it, except for a slight stinging. I'd felt little else. "How was that, Jane?" he asked. I stared at him, startled still. "It gave me immense pleasure," he added. "It did not hurt," I said. "Perhaps I should return the favor?" A large smile spread across his face. "Jane, I should like that very much, but there is something else I would like to do first. Turn around." I obeyed. This was different and thrilling, and I felt my whole body tremble in apprehension. He gently stroked the tail of the whip up and down my back, fluttering it over the contours of my spine. Lazily, he trailed it over my buttocks and down the backs of my thighs until I was gasping with longing. Suddenly, he flicked the crop until it hit me on the right cheek of my behind. I flinched and sighed, closing my eyes and savoring the burning throb of pain that mixed with the bubbling heat of desire pooling in my groin. He flicked it again on my other cheek, and the shock ran right through me to my core. Then he smacked it right across both cheeks, and I writhed with the sweet, stinging bite. I moaned softly. "Does it feel good, Jane?" he asked, walking around to my front so that he was facing me. With his eyes again locked on mine, he brushed the crop against each of my breasts, circling my nipples and watching them harden. His dark eyes scorched mine with their depth, and his brow was wet with sweat. Slowly, I licked my lips and watched him shudder with pleasure. He raised the crop to my mouth, and I took it between my lips gently and bit down hard. He threw the crop away and roughly pulled me to him, raking his fingers through my hair. I groaned with pain and pleasure and felt his hands grope every part of my body feverishly, touching my breasts, my thighs, my neck, and my hips with clasping fingers. I melted under his hands and bent my body into him, wishing to be taken completely. He began tugging on my arm, and I followed him as he moved me smoothly to the opposite wall, pinning me up against it. He gathered my hips in his arms and pulled me up so that I was level with him, pushing my head hard against the wall with his fierce kisses, his tongue teasing the inside of my mouth with slow circles. And suddenly he thrust himself inside of me, and he was easing in and out slowly, rocking my body against the wall. As he pushed deeper and deeper, I cradled my legs around him and leant my head back, closing my eyes. He started to move faster and harder, and then faster and harder still, until I was panting and taking small, sharp breaths. A tightly coiled throb of delight swelled inside me before ripping through my body in a rush of ecstasy. I called out his name and fell limp in his arms as he too gently pulled himself out of me and came. Take a shot. We were silent for a while, holding each other and breathing great sighs of relief as a sense of release tingled through our limbs. "I should like to do that again tomorrow evening," said Mr. Rochester, stroking my hair, "and the next." And then, for some reason, they decide to wait to have sex again until after the wedding. Hey, man. Whatever you believe in, I suppose. So he doesn't ask her to be his mistress after the big Bertha reveal, and I can only imagine it is because she already was one, which is just my greatest grievance again against such an adaptation, is that I think it just drastically changes Jane's character, loses her independence, and loses her, I think, moral and ethical belief system too with this. She does see the Rivers family and spend some time with them, and OMG, thank heavens she didn't sleep with St. John. I was actually really afraid that this might happen. But that section was mostly untouched, with the exception of the author taking a pair of scissors and just cutting many sections and conversations and plot points away from that particular part. And the final sexy scene. And this is when she returns to Mr. Rochester to find him slightly changed, but he is now no longer married.
What delusion has come over me? What sweet madness has seized me?
He groped, and I arrested his wandering hand, imprisoning it in both of mine.
Her very fingers, he cried. Her small, slight fingers. If so, there must be more of her.
The muscular hand broke from my custody, and my arm was seized, then my shoulder, my neck, my waist, and I was gathered to him.
Is it Jane? This is her shape, this is her size,
and this is her voice, I added. She is all here, her heart too.
Jane Eyre, Jane Eyre,
was all he said. I am Jane Eyre, and I have found you out. I am come back to you. I pressed my lips to his once brilliant and now rayless eyes and swept his hair from his brow, kissing that too. He suddenly seemed to arouse himself. The conviction of the reality of all this seized him.
It is you? Is it Jane? You are come back to me, then?
I am.
And you do not lie dead in some ditch under some stream, and you are not a pining outcast amongst strangers?
No, sir, I am an independent woman now of fortune.
But he was too overcome to answer me. My Jane, was all he uttered, touching every part of me that he could. My Jane,
I am here, and I shall never leave again.
You would want to stay here?
He asked, his voice dripping in hope.
With a cripple, a disgusting, vile creature as this?
You are not disgusting and vile, sir. I shall show you. I alighted from him, and he would scarce have let me go, but I promised to come back. Quickly, I ushered Pilate out of the room and locked the door from the inside.
I have dreamt of lying with you once more, I whispered, coming back to his open arms. Jane, you cannot mean it.
I do. I love you, and I always have. I gently ran my finger down his cheek, along the edge of his sideburn to his dark, stubbly chin. Then I carried on, down his neck, tickling his chest.
Hush,
I whispered, ignoring his protests. I began running the fingers of my other hand through his hair and heard him moan softly as a gentle wave of desire rolled through him. I, too, was experiencing the old sensation of thrills that I thought I would never feel again. Leaning forward, I lightly pressed my lips to his and felt him return my sweet kiss. A bank of yearning welled up inside me and overflowed. I began to kiss him more fervently and forced my tongue between his teeth, tasting him. He was exactly as I remembered, and I kissed him harder and harder, hungry for him. In return, he kissed me back and ran his hand expertly over my body, for he evidently remembered it well, cupping my breasts and stroking them over the fabric of my dress. I pulled off his jacket and tugged at his shirt. "But, Jane, I do not care," I interrupted feverishly. "I want you now. I want you too." I tore off his shirt and saw that his chest was still broad, strong, and muscular as I remembered it. I saw not his missing wounded arm or the scars. I saw only him. Then I pulled off his breeches and his other garments and gently guided him down to the rug before the burning embers of the fire. "Jane," he breathed as I kissed him again and again. I let my hand glide up and down his body, relishing the feel of him. I took his erection within my grasp and teased and tugged it mischievously. He grunted and sighed in delight, and, emboldened, I ran my tongue down the length of it before delicately sucking the tip. Leaving him gasping for more, I stood and quickly unlaced my dress, throwing off my clothing with haste. Then I sat astride him and waited as his hands searched my whole body, stroking my thighs, my hips, my stomach, and my behind tenderly. He caressed each of my breasts and thumbed my nipples until they stood hard and erect. Then I leant forward, and whilst I kissed him lightly, I tilted my hips so that he was pushed inside me. "Well, well, well, look who's on the ground now." He grunted and writhed as I thrust, and throwing my head back, I moaned quietly. I angled him to the deepest, furthest point of pleasure inside of me, and took him harder and faster, until my whole body was throbbing with hot, delicious indulgence. "Oh, Jane." He panted, and I knotted my fingers with his and pounded onto him. I thrust once more and then melted into him as an intense thrill of ecstasy overtook my body and left me raw and gasping. I collapsed over him in a hazy daze of pleasure, and he came inside me. Woo! Never thought it would happen. We both lay still, recovering from the release. "Jane, you should have pulled off of me," he chided, stroking my hair as I laid my head on his chest. "I suppose you will have to marry me now," I said with a grin. "Would you marry me, Jane?" "Of course." "I would not sentence you to a life with this monster." "You do not have a choice." He curled his arm around me and held me tightly. "I love you, Jane." "And I love you too." And, reader, I married him. Well, there you go. Several sexy passages for your strange enjoyment. And I don't know what to say. So I'm glad it didn't get super 50 Shades of Grey. I think there were just those two scenes with the bondage and then the crop. But it also, well, this definitely is erotica, I think. I think there are definitely, and I remember doing a blog post that was a silly little scale or spectrum of romance titles, and you know how hot it could go is like hot enough to turn your hoo-ha into ash. And I think that's not here, because the closest we had nipples, obviously, and breasts, but we only have the word erection was basically the only thing. And I mean, the author has came or come multiple times. But I think, you know, we could have had more things happening. So yeah, you know, penis never came up, which I guess that's great that if that didn't, then, you know, vagina is definitely not going to come up. And if vagina is not coming up, then clitoris is not going to come up.
or erogenous nub or knot or something like that. So it could have been worse. But we see certainly a development of Jane's pleasure where she's not getting any pleasure. She's not getting any pleasure. And then pleasure, 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 pleasure. She's also on the ground several times. She's taken from behind. And then luckily, yeah, she gives, she receives. And then finally, I guess they're climactic, pun intended, coupling, he comes inside of her, so I guess all is right with the world. Okay, I am done with this. At least it'll be, you know, a good story to tell friends that I did in fact read some Jane Eyre erotica, but boy, I hope no one is listening to this point. But if you are weird enough to have gotten this far, and I suppose I'm the weirdest of you all because I read all those passages, then we come to the final bit, which is from the airwaves. And I have two comments from the website in regard to episode 8. First, from Siskoid. How fun. I can't claim a lot of knowledge when it comes to Arabic cinema, but I'm a fair fan of Indian films, even as far back as the 50s, though I admit my experience that far back is with straight drama without musical elements, by the great Satyajit Ray, for example. Hopefully that's the right pronunciation. The musicals do tend to be 150 minutes plus. Color me intrigued. Yeah, so of course that was certainly my critique, is that it did seem a bit long, but if that's just sort of the standard of the film culture in India, then that makes sense. And then my second and final comment comes from Brian Linton. Reviewing a foreign film without subtitles, that was impressive. Also, I found the history of Jane Eyre's translation and dissemination around the world to be interesting because it's not something I think of when I pick up a book. Since you brought it up, I just learned about Jane Eyre the musical. My brother and his wife were supposed to see it last weekend, assuming the babysitter came through, and the kids stayed healthy. I don't know how familiar they are with the source material, but I'll ask what they thought of it. Thanks for another incredible episode. Are you the babysitter, Brian? Thank you for thanking me for the incredible episode and just that you're listening, period. And yeah, definitely, please let me know what they think. So this is the penultimate episode of this limited series.
I left this pretty late on purpose. Perhaps you could also accuse me of edging the audience. But hey, it was for titillating purposes and delayed gratification.
And hopefully it paid off. Though I really hope you didn't hear all of that. It was so weird to record. So, so weird. With a red blush upon my cheeks, I shall bid you adieu.
If you'd like to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Jane demands it, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcasts, where you can make a one-time or monthly contribution and unlock various rewards, including getting name-checked on this or any network show of your choice. And perhaps even I, Jane, will bestow upon you the honor of being called Mr. Rochester. Support the network and harvest the good fruits. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts can be found. Send questions or comments to batgirltooracle@gmail.com, don't question it, and follow @batgirltooracle on Twitter. Thank you, dear listeners, for lending your ears to this show. And until next time, pray do read a book. My anaconda don't
hun.